Welcome to everyone to Ukrainian Spaces, which is our podcast that Maxim and I have been doing for 7 months now since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, to elevate Ukrainian voices, and in season two also bring allies to build bridges between Ukraine and other places in the world. But I'll start with asking Maxim how he's feeling today.
Yeah, my husband told me, why would you share anything like that you have COVID to all of your followers? And I was like, you know, that's it, shitty enough. I want something like nice people saying to me. And thank you so much, because there are literally hundreds of comments wishing me well. Although I would say, like, you know, maybe 25% of those comments of people thought that I'm pregnant because of the test picture. So, but on the other hand, it's a way for me to deflect from something that really kind of breaks my heart. It's we're about to see how Russia will claim and annex part of Ukraine where my ancestral family home is. And I know it's not like, it's not a big deal, and it's all like theatrics and bizarre, insane attempt for the empire to, I don't know, just like fucking die. But anyway, it's something that I don't really want to think about much. But you know, the only thing that I have to comment on that they will choke on that, on my home, on our village, on that part of Ukraine, and it's going to be free soon. I have no doubt in it about it.
100%, 100,000%, and I hope that today, you know, Maxim, when we started this was, as much as this space was to inform other people about Ukraine, it was also a space for you and I and others to just come and talk to each other and feel a little bit, I don't know, maybe better if we achieve that goal sometimes. But, you know, we used to call it like a mini therapy session for ourselves. So I really hope that we can take your mind away. I don't think we can, but I hope you know what I mean. I can't find the words after.
You can definitely bring strength to many of Ukrainians like myself. Absolutely. And that's definitely the case. And also wanted to send huge thank you to our growing family of patrons. These broadcasts and this podcast and these events are possible only thanks to your help. And you help us to keep moving, you help us to get motivated, you help us to get more help, which we're getting, to produce a much better quality show than it was when we just haphazardly started as a volunteer sessions. And thank you so much. But if you're not our sponsor, not our patron yet, please do consider, check our Patreon page. You get a bunch of extra content, extra things. Our love, but also most importantly, you get front row seat to ask questions to our featured Ukrainians and featured Ukrainian allies, whether in person or through comments. So I do encourage you to start supporting us in that way as well.
Yeah, and just to, I know we'll be doing a little bit later down the line a little more promotion for this, but we want this show to be more interactive as well, and give you an opportunity to ask the questions to our amazing guests. And Titiana, who's here with us, who's part of our team, has organized a group for our patrons to be able to ask questions during our live broadcasts. So if you aren't yet either, if you are a patron and not part of that group, please join. And if you want to be part of that group and are not a patron, please become a patron, and Titiana will sort you out as well. So just a little innovation moment for our podcast right now. So Maxim, do you want to quickly introduce what we're here to do, and then we'll jump straight in to interviewing Botakoz?
Yeah, so for season two of Ukrainian Spaces, where we usually amplify the diversity of Ukrainian voices and decolonize Ukrainian conversations online, we decided to also feature Ukrainian allies around the world, and to help them to spread their truth and explain their allyship with Ukraine, and also explain their own experiences, whether being colonized by Russia or any other form of oppression. And we do these episodes, which we call bridge episodes, where we feature those Ukraine allies. And for today, it's a special conversation with one of my most favorite people ever, but also a brilliant person. Bodakos,
yeah.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Hey. So look, we have a golden rule for everyone we feature on Ukrainian Spaces. They introduce themselves the way they want. So please do tell us who you are, where you come from, and maybe a bit how your life has changed or how the ongoing genocide in Ukraine also altered the course of your life.
Thank you, Maxim, and thank you, Valeria, and thank you, everyone. My name is Bota. I come originally from Kazakhstan, but I've spent years also in Kyrgyzstan and in Tajikistan, but I studied, I did my PhD in Germany. Right now I teach Soviet history in Switzerland at the University of Basel. And of course, as a scholar of Stalinism and post-Stalinism, this genocide, this war, has changed me enormously. And I would like to start with the expression of deep respect and deep pain for the Ukrainian nation, for people in Ukraine who go through this extreme injustice, who go through this pain. And it's a criminal evil act that is not tolerable. And yes, so I also pray for all the losses, and I would like to, you know, ask for forgiveness for many people, for people, for myself, for not doing enough, for being helpless in this situation. And yes, please know that I share your pain, although of course I cannot feel that pain that you feel. And what you're doing is absolutely amazing. And you give voice not only to people who were colonized, I think, by the Russian Empire, but also by all the people who've experienced this injustice, the genocide, the extermination. So, and what Ukraine is doing is giving hope to the whole of humanity that justice will prevail over injustice, that humanity and humanness will prevail over evil. Thank you so much.
Yes. You have nothing to apologize. This is so moving, but you're one of the most important allies we have, and your work is, I just wanted to say it, your work is invaluable. And sometimes you say things that I cannot like express any better about our shared experiences. So this is just my comment.
Of course.
I'm super grateful for your work.
And we're also very grateful for you for being here today. And as we said in our earlier chat quickly, that it's so important to have people like yourself who are from other countries that have experienced Russian imperialism, colonialism, speak out and share their experiences, just to show that, you know, what Ukraine is experiencing right now, although of course different, every country is different, there's still a lot of things that we have in common. And that's why we feel so deeply for each other. And I'm very grateful for you to be here. And just to also ask and direct our conversation in the beginning, you have been doing an incredible amount to dispel some of these false and fake and, you know, narratives and misconceptions around the Soviet Union and around Russian imperialism. And I just wanted to ask you to tell people who are here just a little bit about what you focus on in your research and what are some of the main topics that you've been studying over the and writing about, of course, over the past years.
So I started my research with studying Stalinism in Central Asia. And I must say that when I first designed my research, I didn't really think about colonialism and I didn't think about imperialism. But once I ended up in archives and I spent 3 years sitting in archives in Tajikistan and around a year in Moscow, this experience totally changed me because this is something that has not been written about. The academic, more or less, consensus was that the Soviet Union was something great for people in Central Asia. But studying the archival material, I thought that this is my mission now to tell the truth about the Soviet past. And, you know, when growing up, of course, I've been experiencing it, but I didn't know how to frame and how to think about it because I was part of that system. But once you read also secret documents, you understand what it was about. So, and this is how it all started. But then I'm looking at the narratives of why we couldn't see that it was an imperial system. And one of the books that I'm writing right now, and I'm co-authoring it with Kimberly St. Julian Vernon, and the book is titled Imperial Innocence, is to look at the narratives and mechanisms to blind not only people in Russia, but also people in ex-colonies to that coloniality. So these are kind of my academic background. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead, sorry.
Yes, so what I also wanted to say is that with this war, when I was researching and writing, I thought that I was doing it for my hypothetical grandchildren because there was no audience for that. I had a lot of frustration at conferences because the academic consensus is that the Soviet Union was not imperial. And so because it's something that is not studied or that is not acknowledged, sorry.
No worries. But you were also told, like I think publicly as well, that lots of researchers like yourself, indigenous voices coming from lands that actually suffered from those injustices, who have unique personal experience of living through them, you were marginalized, ridiculed, and you weren't being taken seriously by Western academia or Western colleagues for trying to approach this topic through the lenses of colonialism, imperialism. Wasn't it the case?
Well, it's especially people who look at the Soviet Union as this communist promise. People who try to criticize American capitalism and imperialism and take the Soviet Union as a proof that communism is a better social system, and that communism achieved equality, that communism brought this prosperity and justice. So, these people would, when you talk about coloniality, then you're very easily and quickly accused in nationalism. So this is one of the reasons it is, for example, very difficult to talk about the hunger in Kazakhstan, because every time you talk about, the genocide, it is not accepted as genocide. It's very difficult to be outspoken. So it's something, so I decided to do it for myself because it was too painful to talk about it publicly and then be accused of not being grateful, you know, to Russians, not being grateful to the Soviet system. So people would say, you know, you are what you are because you've been raised in the Soviet Union. So, but with this war, I think what this war gave to me personally is the voice. You know, the voice, I was reluctant a lot of the time to speak about it because it was, for me, very often it was a very toxic atmosphere. But right now, what is happening, you know, I cannot simply keep silent because it's more than, you know, Korea, it's more than my personal uncomfort. What is going on right now is something that is that transcends, you know, all the comfort. Mm. It's something that we need to speak out. And I think the silencing was part of the Soviet, you know, imperialism.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I felt that I was, you know, I was ashamed of myself. And I was very reluctant to speak up. And so one of my colleagues and friends, Erica Marat, said that right now academics have responsibility. And the responsibility of academics is to contribute to the betterment of humanity. And seeing all these images from Ukraine and looking at all the atrocities and injustice that is taking place, you have to raise the voice because this is the turning point of getting rid of imperialism. This is the turning point of getting rid of Stalinism, of this dictatorial system. Yeah. So, yes.
I think one of the powerful moments you mentioned a bit earlier was about how colonialism hijacks our minds. And this is probably one of the greatest differences between imperialism that, you know, because we're juggling all these terms and people get often confused. And like, I'm not academic, but how I explained it to myself that imperialism, you know, like deals with the territory and with political control. But what colonialism does is hijacking our minds and making sure that we hate our roots, we hate our identities, we are, you know, ashamed of them. So this is what I wanted to like ask you, if you don't mind talking about it. Like, personally, when did you realize that your identity is misshaped or affected by Russian colonialism? And was it something specific, or how you came into realization that, okay, I mean, the way I see myself, my roots, my people is misshaped and distorted by colonialism?
Well, I can say, I can give an example of my experience as a child. So the grandfather of my grandmother was a very famous poet who was, you know, exiled to Siberia for his anti-tsarist Kazakh poetry. And when I was a child, we had, you know, ethnographers, journalists, people who were doing documentaries coming to our house. And so I remember when a group of reporters came to make a documentary, I hid myself in the room and I didn't want to be on TV because I was so ashamed. I was in a Russian school and I was so ashamed that my classmates will see me on Kazakh TV and they will realize that I'm that Kazakh, you know, that I'm real Kazakh who comes from that Kazakh family. And then I kind of erased that memory. And my mother even said that, well, we don't know if, you know, he's really our ancestor. But recently in early July, I received kind of proof that he was, he is my ancestor. And I realized that the desire not to be Kazakh was so profound that we even erase this memory from ourselves. So, but The moment of realization came when I was at a conference, I think, and I was talking about, you know, the deaths, extermination, and then when I was ridiculed, I didn't say anything because, you know, I didn't find words, or I didn't feel that I had an answer. I came home, and then I went to bed, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, I remember I woke up and I told myself, my grandmother's family died during the hunger. So my grandmother grew up in an orphanage, and by statistics, 60% of children died in orphanages during the hunger in Kazakhstan. And I said, you know, my ancestors did not die in vain. You know, they did not die in vain, so that even I perpetrate that humiliation even further. And I need to give them dignity and honor. And I need to write about them because they deserve it. And all the people who suffered from these atrocities, they simply deserve that we talk about them. Because if we silence and if we're ashamed of our own history, then, you know, then we perpetrate, we're complicit with this injustice.
Thank you so much. And it's just such an incredible and important story. And I really, really hope that everyone who's here can really remember this for a really long time, because we just cannot forget exactly what Bota was saying, our history, our trauma, and the people that you know, intentionally the system tried to erase from our minds, from everything. And it's just so incredible to hear you describe a personal story from yourself, and that you've taken now all the way into research and making sure that other people know exactly what our personal stories mean as well. But, you know, you said that, and I think this is partially true and partially what we've been, not partially true, it's true. We've been trying to talk about this here for quite a while. The lack of sometimes language or terminology is some that we have when we discuss what has been happening in our countries for centuries. And I think the term that you referred to back earlier was an extremely important one. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about it, which is imperial innocence. What does that mean? And why is that term significant in understanding Central Asia, but more broadly, the system that sort of dominated the region for such a long time?
Well, originally how I came to that term is when I was discussing kind of the coloniality of the Soviet regime at conferences. Very often, especially from Russian colleagues, I received this response. So do you think that we are bad? You know, so they kind of took it personally. And it was very interesting to me. And I realized that this kind of Russian imperial identity is closely connected to the idea of goodness and to the idea of innocence. So, and in this book, I think one of the kind of purposes is to look at how this kind of imperial understanding was coupled with the idea of innocence. How when we colonize, we don't really colonize, we bring goodness. So, and I think one of the tasks for the Russian society is to decouple imperialism and goodness, and to look for goodness somewhere else and not in imperialism, not in the understanding of the greatness of Russian culture. And this decoupling will be a very painful process, but it is a necessary process to stop atrocities and to stop injustices, to stop the evil that this idea of goodness brings to other people. This kind of idea that there is nothing imperial about us, and there is this greatness, and people should be thankful. Unfortunately, it's uncritically received also in other parts of the world. So,
you actually, you know, we discuss these days very often the the stream of Russians who were running away from responsibility from Russia and, you know, seeking refuge in former colonies, including in Kazakhstan and Central Asia, in, you know, where they can go. And, you know, some of the things that are quite triggering that you also shared, and we saw that their statements at the highest level of Russian opinion makers, even from the opposition, from so-called liberal Russians, who seriously claim that this influx of Russians that are running away from conscription will bring civilization and culture and will actually benefit former colonies. Can you explain, if you don't mind, a bit why such statement is horribly triggering, especially for Central Asia, for Kazakhstan, and what the people should know about the context behind it?
Well, it is only recently that people in Kazakhstan started discussing the hunger that exterminated 40% of the population in early 1930s. So this kind of new wave of finally started to discuss our trauma, started to discuss, you know, what has happened to us. And I consider Kazakh society as a post-traumatic society. In Kazakhstan, we have one of the highest suicide rates in the world. There is a lot of trauma that we carry from that. For many people are unaware of that trauma. But when we talk about 40% of people who died, you can imagine that the other 60% that survived, you know, many of them just survived, you know, like my grandmother, she just survived by luck. And, you know, she didn't have a family, she grew up in an orphanage. So the way that I carry the trauma from her, for me, it became very, very clear recently. So we started talking about it, and also there was a lot of aggressive reaction from the Russian government, because they don't want people in Kazakhstan to talk about this hunger, because it is a very important to protect that image of, you know, positive force in the region. So in December there will be a movie in Kazakhstan that will tell the story of this hunger. So, you know, Russia claims kind of the heritage of the Soviet Union. And we have, of course, Solzhenitsyn, who, you know, said that northern Kazakhstan should belong to Russia. But we didn't have any of the Russian leaders who would even not, you know, excuse or ask for forgiveness, but also simply acknowledge that injustices took place. So from one side, you claim the Soviet, you know, system as your system, but at the same time, you ignore the atrocities that were inflicted by that same regime. So, and this kind of idea, especially people who grew up in the Soviet Union, I think the younger generation, they don't know what it was to live in the Soviet Union and what it was to be a Kazakh in the Soviet Union. It's very traumatic to hear that again, and especially to watch how that rhetoric is also used in order to, you know, attack Ukraine. You know, all these images, yeah, of Pushkin, you know, spreading this great Russian culture. You see the consequences. And of course, for people in Kazakhstan, and, you know, lots of people with whom I discussed it in Kazakhstan, when we see the attack on Ukraine, we also see attack on ourselves, because we share, Kazakhs and Ukrainians share a lot of common in our history. So, and there were also these suggestions from the Russian leadership, you know, that you will be the next ones. So we identify a lot with Ukraine, and we know how dangerous this discourse is. And when people come and they again say the same, for us, it is dangerous.
Yeah. And the fact that they can just, they still feel like it's okay to go about, you know, making decisions for other countries is just so, like, transparent and mind-blowing, how some certain parts of, you know, the world are not seeing how that's extremely unfair, right? Like, why can they just go and say, you know, Kazakhstan this, Ukraine this, I don't know, Georgia this? It's like none of their business, and that's how it should stay. And obviously we're seeing it in an extreme form right now in Ukraine. What I also wanted to ask you a little bit about race and sort of the way that we've discussed this before, but there's this misconception amongst certain parts of the far left and in general just misconceptions that exist that, you know, Soviet Union was this like massive, I don't know, amazing place for people of all races, and there was no racism and, you know, equality for all and all of this stuff. And I know that you've been doing a little bit more work. Well, that's the work that you're doing right now is specifically on, you know, children from, you were saying, Kazakhstan, right, and other places that have been specifically used for labor and things like that. But I just wanted to, in general, ask you sort of if you could talk a little bit more about the race element within the Soviet Union and just anything that can help us, you know, fight this terrible misconception about the fact that everything was great and it was equality for all in that sense.
Well, racism is an important structure of colonialism. I think people who experienced the Soviet regime, I think it's very difficult, I think, to find people in Kazakhstan who would not talk about this experience of being racialized as inferior. You watch Soviet movies and it's everywhere. It's, I think, you know, probably the movie The White Sun of the Desert, where Central Asians are portrayed as these inferior people who need to be saved from their inferiority and who need to be liberated from their, you know, mental degradation. So it's something that is absolutely common. And this racism, it's, I think you can detect it on, you know, many propaganda posters, but also, I mean, this is something that needs to be researched. A lot of this kind of racial problems are not yet researched because I think a lot of scholars were blind to that topic. Also, one should say that it is very painful to talk about it for people. So if you come as a researcher, you have to build trust, you know, speak the local language for people to open up and actually start speaking about it. When during the January events, when I've been talking to a lot of people of older age, I thought that I've experienced enough racism growing up in the Soviet Union, but I was shocked how much racism people of my mother's generation experienced. For example, my mother called herself Aborigines, you know, like мы аборигены. So it's, you know, she was self-racist. So she was racist against herself. And she was like, oh, you know, we are blacks. This is what I heard as a child a lot. So, and I internalized a lot of that. And it was a big struggle for me to emancipate from that self-racism and actually start to value myself. It's a huge emotional work, but also it's a huge mental work. But as a scholar, you know, I could make connections and understand it and be honest about it. But a lot of people, they're ashamed even to think about it and to talk about it because it is so painful.
And you talked like one of the manifestation. It's a part of the work that you mentioned you do is to document the experiences that were often erased by people living under Russian colonial rule through Soviet Union phase or through imperial phase before that. And one of the things that I think that people abroad do not often know or realize is the image of enslaved Central Asian kids who were forcefully put to labor by colonial authorities. Can you tell us a bit more about this story and why it's important for people to learn more about it?
Yes, so child labor in Soviet Central Asia is one of the big themes that I'm exploring. And so children, especially in cotton growing areas, were obliged to work on cotton fields. This happened in autumn, so that they missed a lot of the, you know, schooling because these areas had to fulfill the plan. And to fulfill the plan, it were school children who were made, and they didn't have a choice. So, and these kind of hierarchies between childhood experience and stolen, you know, education. Somebody who grew up in Moscow and somebody who grew up in a village in Uzbekistan, they have very different experiences. One must say that, Agent Orange was used to fertilize the cotton fields. And this is exactly Cotton Orange was used by the U.S. in Vietnam War, you know, as a weapon, whereas in the Soviet Union it was used as a fertilizer, and it's extremely toxic, and it affected the bodies of women and children in a profound way. So we are collecting these stories, and to show how unfair. This Soviet system was to so many people. And there is a lot of, you know, stigma for these people. For example, in Central Asia, they were called the letter G. In Russian, it's a sign of a broken stick, you know. So mm-hmm. children who just stand and, you know, they cannot even stand straightly, and they have to bow with their backs. So, these children were, you know, ridiculed, and so there was a lot of, you know, humiliation that is coming in addition to, you know, their this extractive labor stolen chances for them to advance in society. So these are kind of the experiences that were blind to so many scholars, because there was this understanding that the Soviet Union was something, and was something, advantageous for the people in Central Asia.
Bota, can I ask you one question? And feel free, feel free to answer or not. But there is one thing that bothers me, and you know, as a mixed person with Asian heritage, this is something that's sensitive to me as well. We talk about the inherited racism of Russian colonialism all the time, and how it views indigenous bodies and all that stuff, that it's important to educate the rest. But what bothers me as well, when we talk about what is happening in Ukraine at the moment and genocide of Ukrainians, there's also lots of sometimes nasty Orientalism language also pops up, like, you know, comparing Russians to Mongol invaders, or framing what has happened in Ukraine as this ultimate battle between East and West, which I find, as a mixed Ukrainian person, not cool in any way. But I also would like for people to learn, who use those tropes, maybe not intentionally, to learn more why it is not okay. So you, as a person coming from Central Asia, when you hear those kind of tropes used by everyone, it doesn't matter about the ideology or, you know, geography, how do you feel, and what would you say to people to kind of like those who are those who can be convinced and educated why it's not okay to frame what is happening in Ukraine through Orientalism cliches?
Well, yes, thank you for this question and thank you for raising this issue. So, you know, this kind of these tropes of, you know, the Asian hordes. So for me, I was absolutely struck by Ukrainian leadership who said that we will not call, you know, Chechens as, you know, like when the Chechen troops came, the many in Ukraine said that these are not Chechens, these are Kadyrovets. The Chechen people are fighting with us. And I found it the most profound decolonial moment. You know, I was so touched and I was so excited about it because I thought that this is so smart because this racism about, you know, inferiority of non-Russians was used to suppress them, you know, to dehumanize them and to make the rule and oppression of them as natural, as something good, you know. And when people in Ukraine started to use the term Kadyrovtsi, it is an absolute hope that we can share this solidarity against this racism as a structure of oppression and say, no, you do not demonize these people who are, you know, in a colonial relationship, the Kadyrovtsi, who do not represent the Chechen nation, who were themselves, you know, went through genocides. We see the, you know, injustice of that language. And you don't, you know, abuse one group against the other group, whereas you stay as an innocent, you know, you stay as this good one. So I saw a lot of awareness about it and, you know, understanding that the kind of this racist language is a tool of oppression, is a tool of colonialism. And this differentiation was extremely, I think, liberating for all of us. But, you know, this discourse that, you know, Asians are inferior, they are barbaric, they are, you know, irrational. That's why, you know, it's okay to suppress them. This is something that is our common task. And I think we are changing the situation where we are. I saw a lot of differentiated takes from the Ukrainian side. And I'm very grateful for that. I think it's an amazing thing that has happened. But as Emily Couch recently also wrote in her article, there is this Western coverage. For example, we have the journal? So some of the outlets were speaking about, you know, the Asian hordes or Putin, portraying Putin as a Mongol emperor. This racist language is also in the West. So it's kind of reusing the same tropes that Russia has used to marginalize and to colonize. I think that we really need to problematize it and choose the words, choose the language so that we liberate ourselves from that colonial vocabulary.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's just so important to keep reading the work that you do. And thank you for providing us as well with food for thought in that respect. And we need to keep questioning the language that we use because language is so important. And we've seen how important it has been over the past 7 months and before that. But I'd like to bring in Tetyana, who is our audience engagement editor, who has some questions to you and comments from our wonderful patrons. Tetyana, please go ahead.
Hi, Bota.
Hi, Tetyana.
So firstly, I just wanted to thank you for bringing such passion and humanity in how you speak and how you kind of present your story to the listeners and to the rest of the world. I think it's really important because that's what everybody is leaning into right now, is the humanity. And, you know, I think when the news headlines eventually die off, these are the things that people will remember. These are the conversations, you know. To that end, we have some wonderful patrons who are listening in, and one person actually came in with a really interesting question. And it basically, you know, because everybody is leaning in to understand and educate themselves and empower themselves to understand, you know, what's happening, not just in Ukraine, but also in Central Asia. Do you have any recommendations for any English language resources or any media that you would turn to tell people, listen, this is what you should do in order to kind of familiarize yourselves with, you know, what's happening and with Central Asia? And that comes from a patron named Alessandro.
Yes, yes. So let me prepare a list of, you know, literature and films to watch, and let us share it with Ukrainian spaces at when this recording will be publicized. Yes, I will do that.
Oh, that would be really helpful. And, you know, I think what's interesting is that we receive comments on, you know, our live sessions and our podcasts all the time. But I think this conversation with you in particular has brought out a lot of passion with people who are tuning in. And there is a woman named Alexandra. She is Romanian. And her comment was really interesting because she said, you know, I, you know, all of the East of Europe has inherited trauma in a much broader sense, brought on by quote unquote Russian civilization that they, you know, have said that is, it's good marketing, isn't it? Civilization, you know, and she said it's been carried in our blood from our stories of our grandparents. And that's why so much of Eastern Europe and formerly occupied countries helped Ukraine when this invasion happened in February. And, you know, and it's interesting that she said, you know, nobody was surprised. We were all horrified, but nobody was surprised that this is the Russian playbook. And I think, you know, what you started out saying in the beginning of this session, when you said, you know, it is absolutely heartbreaking, even though nobody's surprised, it's heartbreaking that we are all in this terrible situation together because of the domino effect of what Russia has done to, it's not just about Ukraine, it's about neighboring countries, you know? And I think, like you said, people are realizing that enough is enough. These are the voices that are now appearing as a result of this trauma, you know? So... that, yeah. So everyone is very inspired by you, Bota. I just wanted to share that with you because it's, you know, this is a wonderful conversation.
Bota, if it's okay, and kind of leading on from Tatiana's comment from the comment of our audience, we have one, our favorite question that we usually ask to our Ukrainian guests, it is what it means to them to be Ukrainian, and has that changed at all since this full-scale invasion? But we adapted that question to our wonderful ally guests as well. And I wanted to ask you, and you've spoken about this already a little bit before, but I just wanted to ask you how recent events in Ukraine made you maybe, have they made you rethink? And if so, how have they made you rethink what it means for you personally to be a Kazakh person?
Well, I think that... So I didn't think a lot about my identity until January events in Kazakhstan this year. And so when the government started shooting people, this is where I felt extreme outrage. And when I felt that, you know, I need to raise my voice. And I think this voice, this political stance is what makes you a member of a group. And I think the example of Ukraine also is inspiring in that it shows that, you know, you are part of the group when you speak and when you feel for that group. It's not, you know, during Stalinism, people were reduced, you know, to their, racial groups or to their ethnic groups, which did not exist before, you know. So there was this kind of understanding of dancing and people. So, and these are the kind of the nations, but without voice. So the depolitization of groups of people and selling them as nations was part of that colonial system, and politicizing this idea of a nation, repoliticizing this idea of we are the people who share values, who share norms, who share a vision of a future and of the present. We don't have to be the same. We will be in dialogue and we will, you know, argue with each other about, you know, who we are. But we are talking, we're in this dialogue, and we are determined to build a society. And this is something that is incredible and amazing. And Ukraine gives us hope that we will do that. We will get rid of this, you know, colonial heritage, this Stalinist heritage, and we will become people because we speak, because we have something to say, because we want to build, societies. So we don't want to be silent, and exactly getting rid of the silence, speaking up, doing things, showing solidarity. And this is kind of this, from one side, yes, I feel more, Kazakh, and I feel this kind of process of building of the political nation. But at the same time, the amazing thing that has happened is this solidarity between people of, coming from Central and Eastern Europe, from Ukraine, Caucasus, Central Asia. And yes, I hope that this will be the start of real decolonization, and in the most profound way.
Thank you, Bota, so much. It reminds me once again that first and foremost, colonialism dies in our heads, and then it dies as an empire. And this decolonization is so important. Unfortunately, with such a horrible background, what is happening in Ukraine. But nevertheless, hopefully we will make sure that our generation is the last one that suffers from it.
And it's very unfair that you have to pay the price. And I feel, there are no words to express, the sorrow and the pain that you have to pay for all of us to find ourselves, you know, for all of us to start valuing ourselves, for all of us to start emancipating ourselves. We will be indebted to you. And I think the generations will be indebted to you. And there is, it's very unfair that you have to pay the price. And,
you know, and Kazakhs paid so much as well through decades of systemic genocide inflicted by Russian colonialism. Even this January, where Russian troops were brought to crush your pro-democracy uprising and to crush your demands for being free and democratic in Kazakhstan. And I think this is something that we should also be honoring those people who sacrificed everything for that. But didn't succeed, unfortunately. Bota, thank you so much. I'm sending you the biggest hug possible. I hopefully it will be sometime in near future where we can do it in person and celebrate celebrate the end of Russian colonialism at some point as well during our, I don't want to say our lifetimes. I really want it to be quite soon. So let's keep working on that. But thank you so much for spending time and joining us. It was such a big pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Maxim. Thank you, Valeria. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tatiana, for your kind words. And it was a big, big honor the biggest honor that I had in my life. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Hopefully not the last time. That's definitely not the last time, I can guarantee. For everyone else, thank you so much for joining us. If you're listening to us as a podcast, please make sure that you rate and comment us, because it really helps us to keep trending on podcast platforms, and you can find us everywhere at this point. I also encourage you to use and claim Ukrainian Spaces hashtag on social media platforms to promote us, but also to reach out and suggest topics Ukrainians to feature or Ukrainian allies to feature, or just share any aspect about Ukraine or being Ukrainian or Ukrainian ally you think you should be decolonized for foreigners. And I wanted to also quote a couple and one terrific comment under our live broadcast. It comes from Anindita. She's from India, and she says, "Hey, I'm Anindita from India. I often come here to listen to this wonderful podcast. We all stand with you guys. Thank you so much." So use also this option during live broadcasts to leave your comments as well. We're really happy to amplify that. I think that's it. Apart from, one thing is to say a huge thank you for our patrons, not only to supporting us, but also being an incredible part of our broadcasts. Thank you so much. If you're not a patron yet, please do that, or consider that at least. You can check all the links to our podcast and Patreon page at ukrainianspaces.com. Very simple. So this is it. And then the last thing is Slava Ukraini.
And see you next time. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.